Is the end in sight for theoretical physics? On April the 29th, 1980, I was inaugurated as Lucasian Professor of Mathematics at Cambridge. This essay, my inaugural lecture, was read for me by one of my students. In this essay, I want to discuss the possibility that the goal of theoretical physics might be achieved in the not-too-distant future, say by the end of the century. By this, I mean that we might have a complete, consistent, and unified theory of the physical interactions that would describe all possible observations. Of course, one has to be very cautious about making such predictions. We have thought that we were on the brink of the final synthesis at least twice before. At the beginning of the century, it was believed that everything could be understood in terms of continuum mechanics. All that was needed was to measure a certain number of coefficients of elasticity, viscosity, conductivity, etc. This hope was shattered by the discovery of atomic structure and quantum mechanics. Again, in the late 1920s, Max Born told a group of scientists visiting Göttingen that physics, as we know it, will be over in 6 months. This was shortly after the discovery by Paul Dirac, a previous holder of the Lucasian chair, of the Dirac equation, which governs the behavior of the electron. It was expected that a similar equation would govern the proton, the only other supposedly elementary particle known at that time. However, the discovery of the neutron and of nuclear forces disappointed those hopes. We now know, in fact, that neither the proton nor the neutron is elementary, but that they are made up of smaller particles. Nevertheless, we have made a lot of progress in recent years, and as I shall describe, there are some grounds for cautious optimism that we may see a complete theory within the lifetime of some of those hearing these words. Even if we do achieve a complete unified theory, we shall not be able to make detailed predictions in any but the simplest situations. For example, we already know the physical laws that govern everything that we experience in everyday life. As Dirac pointed out, his equation was the basis of most of physics and all of chemistry. However, we have been able to solve the equation only for the very simplest system, the hydrogen atom, consisting of one proton and one electron. For more complicated atoms with more electrons, let alone for molecules with more than one nucleus, we have to resort to approximations and intuitive guesses of doubtful validity. For macroscopic systems consisting of 10 to the 23rd particles or so, we have to use statistical methods and abandon any pretense of solving the equations exactly. Although in principle we know the equations that govern the whole of biology, we've not been able to reduce the study of human behavior to a branch of applied mathematics. What would we mean by a complete and unified theory of physics? Our attempts at modeling physical reality normally consist of two parts. One, a set of local laws that are obeyed by the various physical quantities. These are usually formulated in terms of differential equations. And two, sets of boundary conditions that tell us the state of some regions of the universe at a certain time and what effects propagate into it subsequently from the rest of the universe. Many people would claim that the role of science is confined to the first of these, and that theoretical physics will have achieved its goal when we have obtained a complete set of local physical laws. They would regard the question of the initial conditions for the universe as belonging to the realm of metaphysics or religion. In a way, this attitude is similar to that of those who in earlier centuries discouraged scientific investigation by saying that all natural phenomena were the work of God and should not be inquired into. I think that the initial conditions of the universe are as suitable a subject for scientific study and theory as are the local physical laws. We shall not have a complete theory until we can do more than merely say that things are as they are because they were as they were. The question of the uniqueness of the initial conditions is closely related to that of the arbitrariness of the local physical laws. One would not regard a theory as complete if it contained a number of adjustable parameters, such as masses or coupling constants, that could be given any values one liked. In fact, it seems that neither the initial conditions nor the values of the parameters in the theory are arbitrary, but that they are somehow chosen or picked out very carefully. For example, if the proton-neutron mass difference were not about twice the mass of the electron, one would not obtain the couple of hundred or so stable nucleides that make up the elements and are the basis of chemistry and biology. Similarly, if the gravitational mass of the proton were significantly different, one would not have had stars in which these nuclides could have been built up. And if the initial expansion of the universe had been slightly smaller or slightly greater, the universe would either have collapsed before such stars could have evolved, or would have expanded so rapidly that stars would never have been formed by gravitational condensation. Indeed, some people have gone so far as to elevate these restrictions on the initial conditions and the parameters to the status of a principle, the anthropic principle, which can be paraphrased as, "Things are as they are because we are." According to one version of the principle, there is a very large number of different separate universes with different values of the physical parameters and different initial conditions. Most of these universes will not provide the right conditions for the development of the complicated structures needed for intelligent life. Only in a small number, with conditions and parameters like our own universe, will it be possible for intelligent life to develop and to ask the question, why is the universe as we observe it? The answer, of course, is that if it were otherwise, there would not be anyone to ask the question. The anthropic principle does provide some sort of explanation of many of the remarkable numerical relations that are observed between the values of different physical parameters. However, it is not completely satisfactory. One cannot help feeling that there is some deeper explanation. Also, it cannot account for all the regions of the universe. For example, our solar system is certainly a prerequisite for our existence, as is an earlier generation of nearby stars in which heavy elements could have been formed by nuclear synthesis. It might even be that the whole of our galaxy was required. But there doesn't seem any necessity for other galaxies to exist, let alone the million or so of them that we see distributed roughly uniformly throughout the observable universe. This large-scale homogeneity of the universe makes it very difficult to believe that the structure of the universe is determined by anything so peripheral as some complicated molecular structures on a minor planet orbiting a very average star in the outer suburbs of a fairly typical spiral galaxy. If we're not going to appeal to the anthropic principle, we need some unifying theory to account for the initial conditions of the universe and the values of the various physical parameters. However, it's too difficult to think up a complete theory of everything all at one go. Though this doesn't seem to stop some people. I get two or three unified theories in the mail each week. What we do instead is to look for partial theories that will describe situations in which certain interactions can be ignored or approximated in a simple manner. We first divide the material content of the universe into two parts. Matter, particles such as quarks, electrons, muons, etc., and interactions, such as gravity, electromagnetism, etc. The matter particles are described by fields of one-half integer spin and obey the Pauli exclusion principle, which prevents more than one particle of a given kind from being in the same state. This is the reason we can have solid bodies that do not collapse to a point or radiate away to infinity. The matter principles are divided into two groups, the hadrons, which are composed of quarks, and the leptons, which comprise the remainder. The interactions are divided phenomenologically into four categories. In order of strength, they are the strong nuclear forces, which interact only with hadrons, electromagnetism, which interacts with charged hadrons and leptons, the weak nuclear forces, which interact with all hadrons and leptons, and finally, the weakest by far, gravity, which interacts with everything. The interactions are represented by integer spin fields that do not obey the Pauli exclusion principle. This means they can have many particles in the same state. In the case of electromagnetism and gravity, the interactions are also long-range, which means that the fields produced by a large number of matter particles can all add up to give a field that can be detected on a macroscopic scale. For these reasons, they were the first to have theories developed for them. Gravity by Newton in the 17th century, and electromagnetism by Maxwell in the 19th century. However, these theories were basically incompatible, because the Newtonian theory was invariant if the whole system was given any uniform velocity, whereas the Maxwell theory defined a preferred velocity, the speed of light. In the end, it turned out to be the Newtonian theory of gravity that had to be modified to make it compatible with the invariance properties of the Maxwell theory. This was achieved by Einstein's general theory of relativity, which was formulated in 1915. The general relativity theory of gravity and the Maxwell theory of electrodynamics were what is called classical theories. That is, they involved quantities that were continuously variable and that could, in principle at least, be measured to arbitrary accuracy. However, a problem arose when one tried to use such theories to construct a model of the atom. It had been discovered that the atom consisted of a small, positively charged nucleus surrounded by a cloud of negatively charged electrons. The natural assumption was that the electrons were in orbit around the nucleus, as the Earth is in orbit around the Sun. But the classical theory predicted that the electrons would radiate electromagnetic waves. These waves would carry away energy and would cause the electrons to spiral into the nucleus, producing the collapse of the atom. This problem was overcome by what is undoubtedly the greatest achievement in theoretical physics in this century, the discovery of the quantum theory. The basic postulate of this is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which states that certain pairs of quantities, such as the position and momentum of a particle, cannot be measured simultaneously with arbitrary accuracy. In the case of the atom, this meant that in its lowest energy state, the electron could not be at rest in the nucleus, because in that case, its position would be exactly defined at the nucleus, and its velocity would also be exactly defined to be zero. Instead, both position and velocity would have to be smeared out with some probability distribution around the nucleus. In this state, the electron could not radiate energy in the form of electromagnetic waves because there would be no lower energy state for it to go to. In the 1920s and 1930s, quantum mechanics was applied with great success to systems such as atoms or molecules, which have only a finite number of degrees of freedom. Difficulties arose, however, when people tried to apply it to the electromagnetic field, which has an infinite number of degrees of freedom, roughly speaking, two for each point of space-time. One can regard these degrees of freedom as oscillators, each with its own position and momentum. The oscillators cannot be at rest because then they would have exactly defined positions and momenta. Instead, each oscillator must have some minimum amount of what are called zero-point fluctuations and a non-zero energy. The energies of all the infinite number of degrees of freedom will cause the apparent mass and charge of the electron to become infinite. A procedure called renormalization was developed to overcome this difficulty in the late 1940s. It consisted of the rather arbitrary subtraction of certain infinite quantities to leave finite remainders. In the case of electrodynamics, it was necessary to make two such infinite subtractions, one for the mass and the other for the charge of the electron. This renormalization procedure has never been put on a very firm conceptual or mathematical basis, but it has worked quite well in practice. Its great success was the prediction of a small displacement, the Lamb shift, in some lines in the spectrum of atomic hydrogen. However, it's not very satisfactory from the point of view of attempts to construct a complete theory, because it doesn't make any predictions of the values of the finite remainders left after making infinite subtractions. Thus, we would have to fall back on the anthropic principle to explain why the electron has the mass and charge that it does. During the 1950s and 1960s, it was generally believed that the weak and strong nuclear forces were not renormalizable. That is, they would require an infinite number of infinite subtractions to make them finite. There would be an infinite number of finite remainders that were not determined by the theory. Such a theory would have no predictive power because one could never measure all the infinite number of parameters. However, in 1971, Gerard de Hooft showed that a unified model of the electromagnetic and weak interactions that had been proposed earlier by Abdus Salam and Steven Weinberg was indeed renormalizable, with only a finite number of infinite subtractions. In the Salam-Weinberg theory, the photon, the spin 1 particle that carries the electromagnetic interaction, is joined by three other spin 1 partners called W+, W- and Z0. At very high energies, these four particles are all predicted to behave in a similar manner. However, at lower energies, a phenomenon called spontaneous symmetry breaking is invoked. to explain the fact that the photon has zero rest mass, whereas W plus, W minus, and Z zero are all very massive. The low-energy predictions of this theory have agreed remarkably well with observation, and this led the Swedish Academy in 1979 to award the Nobel Prize in Physics to Salam Weinberg and Sheldon Glashow, who had also constructed similar unified theories. However, Glashow himself remarked that the Nobel Committee really took rather a gamble, because we do not yet have particle accelerators of high enough energy to test the theory in the regime where unification between the electromagnetic forces carried by the photon and the weak forces carried by the W plus, W minus, and Z zero really occurs. Sufficiently powerful accelerators will be ready in a few years, and most physicists are confident that they will confirm the Salam-Weinberg theory. In fact, the W and Z particles were observed at the CERN laboratory in Geneva in 1983, and another Nobel Prize was awarded in 1984 to Carlo Rubbia and Simon van der Meer, who led the team that made the discovery. The person who missed out on a prize was de Hooft. The success of the Salam-Weinberg theory led to the search for a similar renormalizable theory of the strong interactions. It was realized fairly early on that the proton and other hadrons, such as the Pi meson, could not be truly elementary particles, but that they must be bound states of other particles called quarks. These seem to have the curious property that although they can move fairly freely within a hadron, it appears to be impossible to obtain just one quark on its own. They always come either in groups of three, like the proton or neutron, or in pairs, consisting of a quark and antiquark, like the Pi meson. To explain this, quarks were endowed with an attribute called color. It should be emphasized that this has nothing to do with our normal perception of color. Quarks are far too small to be seen by visible light. It's merely a convenient name. The idea is that quarks come in three colors, red, green, and blue, but that any isolated bound state, such as a hadron, has to be colorless, either a combination of red, green, and blue, like the proton, or a mixture of red and anti-red, green and anti-green, and blue and anti-blue, like the Pi meson. The strong interactions between the quarks are supposed to be carried by spin 1 particles called gluons, rather like the particles that carry the weak interaction. The gluons also carry color, and they and the quarks obey a renormalizable theory called quantum chromodynamics, or QCD for short. A consequence of the renormalization procedure is that the effective coupling constant of the theory depends on the energy at which it's measured, and decreases to zero at very high energies. This phenomenon is known as asymptotic freedom. It means that quarks inside a hadron behave almost like free particles in high-energy collisions, so that their perturbations can be treated successfully by perturbation theory. The predictions of perturbation theory are in reasonable qualitative agreement with observation, but one cannot yet really claim that the theory has been experimentally verified. At low energies, the effective coupling constant becomes very large and perturbation theory breaks down. It's hoped that this infrared slavery will explain why quarks are always confined in colorless bound states, but so far, no one has been able to demonstrate this really convincingly. Having obtained one renormalizable theory for the strong interactions and another one for the weak and electromagnetic interactions, it was natural to look for a theory to combine the two. Such theories are given the rather exaggerated title Grand Unified Theories, or GUTs. This is rather misleading because they are neither all that grand, nor fully unified, nor complete theories, in that they have a number of undetermined renormalization parameters, such as coupling constants and masses. Nevertheless, they may be a significant step toward a complete unified theory. The basic idea is that the effective coupling constant of the strong interactions, which is large at low energies, gradually decreases at high energies because of asymptotic freedom. On the other hand, the effective coupling constant of the Salam-Weinberg theory, which is small at low energies, gradually increases at high energies, because this theory is not asymptotically free. If one extrapolates the low energy rate of increase and decrease of the coupling constants, one finds that the two coupling constants become equal at an energy of about 10 to the 15th GeV. GeV means a billion electron volts, This is about the energy that would be released if a hydrogen atom could be totally converted into energy. By comparison, the energy released in chemical reactions, like burning, is of the order of 1 electron volt per atom. The theories propose that above this energy, the strong interactions are unified with the weak and electromagnetic interactions, but that at lower energies, there is spontaneous symmetry breaking. An energy of 10 to the 15th GeV is way beyond the scope of any laboratory equipment. The present generation of particle accelerators can produce center of mass energies of about 10 GeV, and the next generation will produce energies of 100 GeV or so. This will be sufficient to investigate the energy range in which the electromagnetic forces should become unified with the weak forces according to the Salam-Weinberg theory, but not the enormously high energy at which the weak and electromagnetic interactions would be predicted to become unified with the strong interactions. Nevertheless, there can be low-energy predictions of the grand unified theories that might be testable in the laboratory. For example, the theories predict that the proton should not be completely stable, but should decay with a lifetime of order 10 to the 31st years. The present experimental lower limit on the lifetime is about 10 to the 30th years, and it should be possible to improve this. Another observable prediction concerns the ratio of baryons to photons in the universe. The laws of physics seem to be the same for particles and antiparticles. More precisely, they're the same if particles are replaced by antiparticles, right-handed is replaced by left-handed, and the velocities of all particles are reversed. This is known as the CPT theorem, and it is a consequence of basic assumptions that should hold in any reasonable theory. Yet the Earth, and indeed the whole solar system, is made up of protons and neutrons without any antiprotons or antineutrons. Indeed, such an imbalance between particles and antiparticles is yet another a priori condition for our existence. For if the solar system were composed of an equal mixture of particles and antiparticles, they would all annihilate each other and leave just radiation. From the observed absence of such annihilation radiation, we can conclude that our galaxy is made entirely of particles rather than antiparticles. We do not have direct evidence of other galaxies, but it seems likely that they are composed of particles, and that in the universe as a whole, there is an excess of particles over antiparticles of about 1 particle per 10 to the 8th photons. One could try to account for this by invoking the anthropic principle, but grand unified theories actually provide a possible mechanism for explaining the imbalance. Although all interactions seem to be invariant under the combination of C, replace particles by antiparticles, P, change right-handed to left-handed, and T, reverse the direction of time, there are known to be interactions that are not invariant under T alone. In the early universe, in which there is a very marked arrow of time given by the expansion, these interactions could produce more particles than antiparticles. However, the number they make is very model-dependent, so that agreement with observation is hardly a confirmation of the grand unified theories. So far, most of the effort has been devoted to unifying the first three categories of physical interactions: the strong and weak nuclear forces and electromagnetism. The fourth and last, gravity, has been neglected. One justification for this is that gravity is so weak that quantum gravitational effects would be large only at particle energies, way beyond those in any particle accelerator. Another is that gravity does not seem to be renormalizable. In order to obtain finite answers, it seems that one may have to make an infinite number of infinite subtractions, with a correspondingly infinite number of undetermined finite remainders. Yet one must include gravity if one is to obtain a fully unified theory. Furthermore, the classical theory of general relativity predicts that there should be space-time singularities at which the gravitational field would become infinitely strong. These singularities would occur in the past, at the beginning of the present expansion of the universe, the Big Bang, and in the future, in the gravitational collapse of stars, and possibly of the universe itself. The prediction of singularities presumably indicates the classical theory will break down. However, there seems to be no reason why it should break down until the gravitational field becomes strong enough that quantum gravitational effects are important. Thus, a quantum theory of gravity is essential if we are to describe the early universe and then give some explanation for the initial conditions, beyond merely appealing to the anthropic principle. Such a theory is also required if we're to answer the question, does time really have a beginning and possibly an end, as is predicted by classical general relativity? Or are the singularities in the Big Bang and the Big Crunch smeared out in some way by quantum effects? This is a difficult question to give a well-defined meaning to, when the very structures of space and time themselves are subject to the uncertainty principle. My personal feeling is that singularities are probably still present, though one can continue time past them in a certain mathematical sense. However, any subjective concept of time that was related to consciousness or the ability to perform measurements would come to an end. What are the prospects of obtaining a quantum theory of gravity and of unifying it with the other three categories of interactions? The best hope seems to lie in an extension of general relativity called supergravity. In this, the graviton, the spin 2 particle that carries the gravitational interaction, is related to a number of other fields of lower spin by so-called supersymmetry transformations. Such a theory has the great merit that it does away with the old dichotomy between matter, represented by particles of one-half integer spin, and interactions, represented by integer spin particles. It also has the great advantage that many of the infinities that arise in quantum theory cancel each other out. Whether they all cancel out to give a theory that is finite, without any infinite subtractions, is not yet known. It's hoped that they do, because it can be shown that theories that include gravity are either finite or non-renormalizable. That is, if one has to make any infinite subtractions, then one will have to make an infinite number of them with a corresponding infinite number of undetermined remainders. Thus, if all the infinities in supergravity turn out to cancel each other out, we could have a theory that not only fully unifies all the matter particles and interactions, but that is complete in the sense that it does not have any undetermined renormalization parameters. Although we do not yet have a proper quantum theory of gravity, let alone one that unifies it with other physical interactions, we do have an idea of some of the features it should have. One of these is connected with the fact that gravity affects the causal structure of space-time. That is, gravity determines which events can be causally related to one another. An example of this, in the classical theory of general relativity, is provided by a black hole, which is a region of space-time in which the gravitational field is so strong that any light or other signal is dragged back into the region and cannot escape to the outside world. The intense gravitational field near the black hole causes the creation of pairs of particles and antiparticles, one of which falls into the black hole and the other of which escapes to infinity. The particle that escapes appears to have been emitted by the black hole. An observer at a distance from the black hole can measure only the outgoing particles, and he cannot correlate them with those that fall into the hole because he cannot observe them. This means that the outgoing particles have an extra degree of randomness or unpredictability over and above that usually associated with the uncertainty principle. In normal situations, the uncertainty principle implies that one can definitely predict either the position or the velocity of a particle, or one combination of position and velocity. Thus, roughly speaking, one's ability to make definite predictions is halved. However, in the case of particles emitted from a black hole, the fact that one cannot observe what is going on inside the black hole means that one can definitely predict neither the positions nor the velocities of the emitted particles. All one can give are probabilities that particles will be emitted in certain modes. It seems, therefore, that even if we find a unified theory, we may be able to make only statistical predictions. We would also have to abandon the view that there is a unique universe that we observe. Instead, we would have to adopt a picture in which there is an ensemble of all possible universes with some probability distribution. This might explain why the universe started off in the Big Bang in almost perfect thermal equilibrium, because thermal equilibrium would correspond to the largest number of microscopic configurations, and hence the greatest probability. To paraphrase Voltaire's philosopher Pangloss, we live in the most probable of all possible worlds. What are the prospects that we'll find a complete unified theory in the not-too-distant future? Each time we have extended our observations to smaller length scales and higher energies, we've discovered new layers of structure. At the beginning of the century, the discovery of Brownian motion with a typical energy particle of 3 × 10^-2 eV showed that matter is not continuous, but is made up of atoms. Shortly thereafter, it was discovered that these supposedly indivisible atoms are made up of electrons revolving about a nucleus with energies of the order of a few electron volts. The nucleus, in turn, was found to be composed of so-called elementary particles, protons and neutrons, held together by nuclear bonds of the order of 10 to the 6th EV. The latest episode in this story is that we've found that the proton and electron are made up of quarks, held together by bonds of the order of 10 to the 9th EV. It's a tribute to how far we've come already in theoretical physics that it now takes enormous machines and a great deal of money to perform an experiment whose results we cannot predict. Our past experience might suggest that there is an infinite sequence of layers of structure at higher and higher energies. Indeed, such a view of an infinite regress of boxes within boxes was official dogma in China under the Gang of Four. However, it seems that gravity should provide a limit, but only at the very short length scale of 10 to the minus 33rd centimeters, or the very high energy of 10 to the 28th EV. On length scales shorter than this, one would expect that space-time would cease to behave like a smooth continuum, and that it would acquire a foam-like structure because of quantum fluctuations of the gravitational field. There is a very large unexplored region between our present experimental limit of about 10 to the 10th EV and the gravitational cutoff at 10 to the 28th EV. It might seem naive to assume, as grand unified theories do, that there are only one or two layers of structure in this enormous interval. However, there are grounds for optimism. At the moment, at least, it seems that gravity can be unified with the other physical interactions only in some supergravity theory. There appears to be only a finite number of such theories. In particular, there is a largest such theory, the so-called N equals 8 extended supergravity. This contains one graviton, 8 spin 3/2 particles called gravitanus, 28 spin 1 particles, 56 spin 1/2 particles, and 70 particles of spin 0. Large as these numbers are, they're not large enough to account for all the particles that we seem to observe in strong and weak interactions. For instance, the N equals 8 theory has 28 spin 1 particles. These are sufficient to account for the gluons that carry the strong interactions and two of the four particles that carry the weak interactions, but not the other two. One would therefore have to believe that many or most of the observed particles, such as gluons or quarks, are not really elementary, as they seem at the moment, but that they are bound states of the fundamental N equals 8 particles. It's not likely that we shall have accelerators powerful enough to probe these composite structures within the foreseeable future, or indeed ever, if one makes a projection based on current economic trends. Nevertheless, the fact that these bound states arose from the well-defined N equals 8 theory should enable us to make a number of predictions that could be tested at energies that are accessible now or will be in the near future. The situation might thus be similar to that for the Salam-Weinberg theory, unifying electromagnetism and weak interactions. The low-energy predictions of this theory are in such good agreement with observation that the theory is now generally accepted, even though we have not yet reached the energy at which the unification should take place. There ought to be something very distinctive about the theory that describes the universe. Why does this theory come to life while other theories exist only in the minds of their inventors? The N equals 8 supergravity theory does have some claims to be special. It seems that it may be the only theory, one, that is in four dimensions, two, that incorporates gravity, and three, that is finite without any infinite subtractions. I've already pointed out that the third property is necessary if we're to have a complete theory without parameters. It is, however, difficult to account for properties 1 and 2 without appealing to the anthropic principle. There seems to be a consistent theory that satisfies properties 1 and 3, but that does not include gravity. However, in such a universe, there would probably not be sufficient in the way of attractive forces to gather together matter in the large aggregates that are probably necessary for the development of complicated structures. Why space-time should be four-dimensional is a question that is normally considered to be outside the realm of physics. However, there is a good anthropic principle argument for that too. Three space-time dimensions, that is, two space and one time, are clearly insufficient for any complicated organism. On the other hand, if there were more than three spatial dimensions, the orbits of planets around the Sun, or electrons around a nucleus, would be unstable, and they would tend to spiral inward. There remains the possibility of more than one time dimension, but I, for one, find such a universe very hard to imagine. So far, I've implicitly assumed that there is an ultimate theory. But is there? There are at least three possibilities. One, there is a complete unified theory. Two, there is no ultimate theory. But there is an infinite sequence of theories that are such that any particular class of observations can be predicted by taking a theory sufficiently far down the chain. And three, there is no theory. Observations cannot be described or predicted beyond a certain point, but are just arbitrary. The third view was advanced as an argument against the scientists of the 17th and 18th centuries. How could they formulate laws that would curtail the freedom of God to change his mind? Nevertheless, they did, and they got away with it. In modern times, we've effectively eliminated possibility three by incorporating it within our scheme. Quantum mechanics is essentially a theory of what we do not know and cannot predict. Possibility two would amount to a picture of an infinite sequence of structures at higher and higher energies. As I said before, this seems unlikely, because one would expect that there would be a cut-off at the Planck energy of 10 to the 28th EV. This leaves us with possibility one. At the moment, the N equals 8 supergravity theory is the only candidate in sight. There are likely to be a number of crucial calculations within the next few years that have the possibility of showing that the theory is no good. If the theory survives these tests, it will probably be some years more before we develop computational methods that will enable us to make predictions, and before we can account for the initial conditions of the universe as well as the local physical laws. These will be the outstanding problems for theoretical physicists in the next 20 years or so. But to end on a slightly alarmist note, they may not have much more time than that. At present, computers are a useful aid in research, but they have to be directed by human minds. If one extrapolates their recent rapid rate of development, however, it would seem quite possible that they will take over altogether in theoretical physics. So maybe the end is in sight for theoretical physicists, if not for theoretical physics. Supergravity theories seem to be the only particle theory that is in four dimensions, that incorporates gravity, and that is finite without any infinite subtractions. But since this lecture was given in 1980, there has been a great wave of interest in what are called superstring theories. In these, the basic objects are not point particles, but extended objects like little loops of string. The idea is that what appears to us to be a particle is really a vibration on a loop. These superstring theories seem to reduce to supergravity in the low energy limit. But so far, there has been little success in obtaining experimentally testable predictions from superstring theory.